Log Talk Radio.
Few Americans truly understand our prison system.
Prisoners under the 13th Amendment essentially work as...
in a form of neo-slavery.
End mass incarceration.
Millions for prisoners, human rights.
March on Washington, August 2017.
No Shackles Radio.
About revolution, they must speak about a change, because we are human beings. We got to be treated like human beings.
We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be beaten or driven as such.
If you put people under these kind of conditions, they're going to rebel, you know, and that's what Attica teaches you.
What has happened here is but the sound before the fury of those who are...
Peace. I'd like to thank everybody for sharing this time with us tonight on No Shackles Radio. My name is Malah Devon Malah. I'll be your lead host. Right now, I want to introduce my other host, first on with Mama Condi.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to No Shackles Radio. Thank you in advance for your participation and for your willingness to listen and be a part. Thank you very much.
And my second co-host, Jen.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for attending the No Shackles Radio show this evening, and I hope you enjoy the show.
And our special guest tonight, Alaa B.
Peace, everyone, and thank you for having me on No Shackles Radio and No Shackles on the Mind. And there'll definitely be no shackles on the body.
Definitely, definitely. I'd like to thank everybody for listening to us tonight, man. It's going to be a wonderful show. I'd like to thank y'all for sharing your time with us and things of that nature. The first thing that I want to share is that we have a T-shirt, sweatshirt, cup campaign. You know, we are people power movement. And, you know, we only exist because the people exist. And what we need to do is real great, and we need your support. So if you go to our page, the Millions for Human Rights March, you can actually see the things that we are trying to do. And we're trying to raise funds right now with putting out T-shirts, putting out sweatshirts, putting out cups and paraphernalia, because we don't have no corporate sponsors and things like that. And we need your support. We need the people's support, because we like the ants, and the ants got to move together, you know. At this time, we always do something, which is we share from last week to this week the people that was took from by the police, because we should always honor those that passed away through the state violence. And from last week was November 12th. Now, depending on when these killings came in, I'm going to reshare from November 12th all the way up to today. In Arizona, you have Richard T. Harold Harrell Jr., 29. Also in Alaska, you had James Dale Richard, 40. On November 13th in Georgia, you had Jackie Sander Wilms Jr. November 13, 2016, Oklahoma, you had Daniel Laguna, 21. November 13, California, you had Juan Carlos Fernandez, age 22. November 13, South Carolina, you had Michael Sawyer, 31. November 14, you had a couple, Norman Ellen, 86, Salima Ellen, 87. That was in Indiana. November 15, in Pennsylvania, you had Rasheem Singletary, 25. November 15, Texas, Robert Daffin, 38. November 16, California, Edmund Lightley, 56. November 16, Missouri, Bruce Lee Edward Johnson, 39. November 17, Oklahoma, James Bosch, 53. November 18, 2016, Joseph Fletcher, 35. November 18, Dontre Carter, 25, Georgia. November 18, Florida, Samson Florent, 25. November 18, Arizona, Gabriel Parker, 48. November 19, which is today, Stephen Vandell, Oklahoma, 56. Now, as you can see, it seems to be a lot of police killings this week, and it's always sad when people get killed by the police. You know, it's like we almost living in Nazi Germany, and it's supposed to be America. Another thing that I want to share that prison advocate that we should look out for is some of these Trump appointees. They didn't get nominated yet because he's still president-elect. But one of the people that he got that he's looking towards to nominate for attorney general is Jeff Sessions. He's a senator for Alabama, and he's straight from the Jim Crow era. So that'll be something that we need to watch. If you don't know about him, Google him, see what his policies like. He also has been involved with the attorney general's office in his local state, and he's an interesting character by far. Now, moving along, you know, I've got a question that I want to ask, you know, this roundtable discussion. The first question I want to ask, and I want the people out there to listen real good to this, because this is going to make you say, there are six banks that underwrite private prison. These six banks is Wells Fargo, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, PNP Paribas, SunTrust, and U.S. Bank Corp. Another fact, when Trump was elected president, the two biggest private prisons, one is GEO Group and the other one is CoreCivic, which used to be known as Corrections Corporation of America. These are the two largest private corporation companies in the U.S. Both of them jumped respectively 21 to 43%. Now, what I want to ask my panel is, what do you think about the facts that I just read? Mama Condi.
Well, my when I hear that question, it makes me think about a position that I have about the 1,024 killings of black people by white cops this year so far. It's very my response is very similar to that. My solution to that is, we pay taxes, the tax dollars pay police salaries, therefore we shouldn't pay taxes. Banks are supporting the imprisonment of people, which is an enslavement of people, and therefore we shouldn't put our money in their banks. To me, it's all equal.
What you think about that, Jennifer?
But I'm surprised that the list is so short. Number one, I think it's more banks involved in the private prison that support or underwrite the private prison industry, and I'd be interested to find out how we can maybe get that information. At first, I was a little surprised. Because I have an account at Wells Fargo that I need to now close, because I found out that they're supporting the private prison industrial complex. But I think the list is rather short. That's my thinking about it. I think there's way more people involved. I'm also curious to know who owns stock in CoreCivic and GEO Group.
Definitely. So, as well, this is for the callers. Any callers out there, if you want to join in and ask a question or something, press the 1 on your keypad, and I will definitely get to you when I can. Now, Allah B, what you think about that?
Well, first, I would just like to, I was reflecting on the, you know, death since November 12th to the 19th, even one the date. And I read a report that said that a law enforcement agent or either peace officer in America kills a black person, man, woman, or child every 28 hours. And what you just read is consistent with that very report. As you see, it's not a big uproar, although these brothers and sisters are dying at the hands of, you know, these so-called law enforcement agents. And there's no big uproar because there was no video of it. But this has been a pattern forever. In regards to the prisons for pay, it's always been like, you know, the slave camps. Go back to the slave camps. It's always been about profit. Now we just finding out that the underwriters of these huge profit making ventures is big transnational corporations that has PR companies that, you know, paint the greatest picture of them as benevolent, philanthropic companies and good for the people. But they're not, and they never have been. And if we go back, we can find traces of them actually being involved with the transatlantic slave trade. But a solution, as we see coming out of Atlanta, Georgia, that the brothers and sisters had taken the money out of these major corporate banks and entities, and now is putting their money into black-owned banks. And this should be one of the solutions that we should function as a collective responsibility endeavor on our part to take our money out of these banks that is not for us and maintaining these prison systems and put it in our own banks. There are some banks that are black-owned, although they, you know, follow almost the same account principles as the major corporations, but they would be for us, they would be by our own. And mind you, it would be just a trickle of the $1 trillion that blacks in America generate on their purchasing power, national income. You know, if we just think collectively in regards to our responsibility to ourselves, that these major banks is not for us, and they maintaining the prison corporation of its America, always been a corporate entity. It never been for the people, by the people, and other people. We was counted out from the very writing of the Constitution, although we was very instrumental in all the wars for the freedom, just and equality, as they say, liberty of America. But yeah, a good solution is being started in Atlanta, and we could follow the example of those brothers and sisters and take our money out of all them banks and put it in a black-owned bank.
So let me leave with another question, because that was a good question, because I heard Jen said she had money in Wells Fargo, and it's kind of funny because when I was leaving Virginia from being formerly incarcerated, like when they the certain classes that they had, one of the banks that they tried to get us to deal with, to open up account with, was Wells Fargo. Now, Advocates for Prison Human Rights, you know, I think that we all in consensus that they should pull their money from these banks, you know. But I want to go a step further because, you know, this movement, the Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March, it's an all-inclusive movement. And I think that any prison advocate, you know, should pull their money out of these major banks and put them into community-orientated banks. You know, because I think that we do ourselves a disservice and we say we stand for certain principles, but yet we're going to let people use our money to underwrite two of the biggest organizations that not just only house our people, but give them poor services while they're there. And I think that that's incumbent to us to always recognize that, yo, follow the money. Like, I remember when I was younger, when the apartheid was going on in South Africa, I used to hear, I was real young. I was in my teens, my early teens, and people was talking about companies like Reeboks or all these other companies that was doing business with corporations in South Africa. You had a big movement amongst rappers like Stetsasonic and them. They was telling people, yo, they was making people aware for one, and then second, they was telling people to pull their money. Don't support corporations or companies that support in South Africa. I think now, this is my question. Do we need a campaign, the same type of campaign to get out front? This, and anybody can answer this question of our people that got our celebrities, our music people that got the ear of the public to make songs to say, pull your support from these companies that support the prison industry complex. Anybody can take that question.
Well, most definitely. I would say most definitely. And one of the interesting things about the bank in Atlanta is that it was started by one of the movers in the rap industry or the hip-hop industry, Jermaine Dupri. And he, you know, handles a lot of groups. So it's his influence that this is one of the ways that we had to go. So hopefully, as you just suggested, that they start rapping about it and showing it in videos of how to divest from these banks that is running the deals to keep us enslaved, so to speak, and generate capital for our own self by investing in our own banks all across the country and really advocating promote the ideas is to really educate the sleeping mass. You know, and of course we got to use all the mediums of education that we can. The videos, the internet, definitely word of mouth, you know, teaching at whatever schools that we can. All of that is definitely necessary. And you touched on the greater point that when, you know, we were dealing with the apartheid in another country, South Africa, bypassing the Jim Crowism here, we really generated some real noise, you know, centered around our brother that was in prison in South Africa, Nelson Mandela, you know, and if it takes a similar effort, it would have to be definitely accelerated because things is real critical today, and we shouldn't have no fear of any of this that they're trying to promote in our society today, because we done been up under all these, in my estimate, racist presidents that haven't done anything for blacks or original people or anything for any poor people, you know? So, yeah, it's well overdue that we just do what we got to do, educate, you know, and eventually we definitely going to liberate. But as they say,
definitely. Let me share this little bit of history. A lot of people talk about Dr. Martin Luther King. Don't forget he was a doctor, junior, that when he got assassinated, he was actually organizing the poor people march on Washington, D.C.
Yes.
They knew that King could bring an all-exclusive movement, plus he was against the Vietnam War. That's a little bit of history I don't tell you. That so he was organizing a poor people campaign, the March on Washington, when he was assassinated. And I think that what we're trying to do here with this march, the Prisoners' Human Rights March on Washington, August 19, 2017, it's in the same vein. We want to bring everybody out. We want to bring everybody to support, because you know why? The prison industrial complex touches us all, touches everybody in this country. And I think that, you know, we seen that with the Trump election, which me personally, I think that this was the most poorest election season that I've seen in my adult life. I can't talk about when I was younger. I can't really remember when Reagan was running and things like that. I just know the effect of the Reagan era. But since I was aware to be able to watch politics, I think that, you know, we're in a sad state in America right now, and I think that the divisiveness that Trump represents, we can't allow that to interfere with what we're trying to do as a movement, because at the end of the day, we got to be a fist and we got to punch the prison industrial complex in the face. You know, for anybody that's listening out there to the audience, you know, if you got a question, if you press the one on the queue, I definitely will see you and I will definitely get to you. Now, before I move into the next discussion question, I want to ask my co-host Jennifer or Mama Condi, do y'all have anything to add on to that situation, that topic?
I would just say that I agree that I think we all need to pay more attention to places that we do business with. I didn't even think to do any research on Wells Count. I was just worried, you know, I was just looking to open up a bank account, and that was the bank that I chose. But since my awareness has increased a whole lot more over the past, I would say, 6 or 7 months, I pay more attention to what I'm doing so that I can make more informed decisions. And when Wells Fargo was in the news a few months ago about a large number of their staff were creating online accounts for people, and some kind of way they were benefiting from it. And as a result, they're closing a lot of their branches, and the bank has to pay back a huge fine. That was a cue for me then to close the account, but I didn't. But I just, you know, I just think that it makes me more aware. It makes me pay more attention to what I'm doing now.
That's definitely interesting. I think that we all need to pay aware to what we're doing, because it's just not these banks that support. The banks is crucial because they underwrite, they give them credit. Without credit, them private prisons can't exist. You know, but it's also other corporations that support prison. They use prison labor, whether directly or indirectly. And I think that as time go on, we need to identify all these corporations that use prison labor in some form, shape, or fashion and put them on blast. And I think we need to help with the people because, you know, we're a people power movement and we like the ants. And you know how the ants move when they move in force. You know, they devour everything in their way. So we got to keep in mind that we the ants. So I want to go to the next question, but before I go, if anybody got questions, press the one on your dial, and I will definitely see you, and I will definitely log you in. Okay, now, the second discussion question.
Excuse me.
Go ahead, Mom. Go ahead, Mama Condi.
You were getting ready to keep rolling, and I wanted to say something.
Go ahead.
I was a part of that period in time when we were fighting apartheid. I was and still am a member of the Pan-Africanist Congress of Azania, PAC. We are the nationalists. ANC are the civil rights activists. And one of the things that we did then that helped get Nelson Mandela out was against the corporations, but we also went up against the individuals like Stephanie Mills, for example. We had put the word out that no artists were to go to Sun City and perform. She, Nikki Giovanni, and a bunch of other folks went in spite of the demand that the people made that we not support apartheid, and it paid off. So it's something to consider that we put pressure on those who kind of go along with things being okay the way they are. They're not okay the way they are. And if we find artists, individuals, corporations, elected officials, you know, there are various ways that we can put pressure on them, just like we did when we were fighting the apartheid movement. Matter of fact, there are ways we can be supportive as well. For example, a lot of us who are independent African-centered schools, there was one on every side of town in Philly. I lived in Philly at that time. We all pooled our resources, and we brought Sam Nujoma, president of Namibia, and Robert Mugabe, who is now president of Zimbabwe. They weren't then. They were ZANU and ZAPU fighting for independence. We brought them to the States, you know, in support of this anti-apartheid movement. There's no reason why we can't do the same thing in present day in this movement, bring people forward who are symbolic of what we're doing, who are dedicated to what we're doing, and who are a part of what we're doing. Just a thought.
Good thought.
That's definitely, because I think that, you know, artists and actors, from even what I've seen or studied, you know, people from like Jim Brown, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, not going to the Olympics that year, Jim Brown leaving the NFL when he was 29 years old, on top of his game, I must say, and just artists in general, especially in the early hip-hop movement, you know, when you had songs from Stetson Sonic, you know, when they named all the countries in Africa, when you had music like Self-Destruction, when you had all these West Coast music like We All in the Same Game. I think that music is pivotal into what we're trying to do. And with that, I want to move into our second question, discussion question. In Colorado, when voters, when the vote took place a few weeks or 2 weeks ago, they had something on there, however you go about something for them to vote on. They was voting to keep the archaic language in the state constitution that allowed forced unpaid labor for people convicted of a crime. Now, that was what they voted on. It didn't pass. It slightly didn't pass. It was like 50 to 49 point something percent. And that goes directly to what we're doing with the Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March, when we say that, yo, we're trying to abolish the 13th Amendment. Because for people out there that don't know, each individual state has a state constitution that follows the federal constitution. Now, with that being said, knowing that this measure didn't pass, now some people say it was due to the way that it was worded. When I read it, it was kind of worded kind of crazy that it wasn't clear, so it probably would have went the other way. But the bottom line, it was denied to change the language about unpaid labor for people convicted of a crime. Now, I want to know, what do that statement send to the advocate of abolish the 13th Amendment? I'm going to start off with Mama Condi.
You know, I always promote Dr. Sharcey McIntyre's book, Criminalizing a Race. Language is a very intriguing thing. When you talk about convicted of a crime, you've got to put it in a specific context because, for example, people of color are considered to be criminals anyway by the system. You also have the Three-Fifths Compromise, Dred Scott, Plessy versus Ferguson, and Rex 84. They all support the idea of being criminals, so therefore anybody convicted of a crime that's a foregone conclusion. You know, the language is manipulative, suggestive, and criminal in itself at best. The second part of my comment is that indigenous law and international law supersede all civil law, be it federal, state, municipal, county, whatever. So we need to also study and be very aware of those laws that we can submit our grievances in world court, just in case what we're trying to accomplish doesn't work in any of the levels of civil courts in this country. Thank y'all for listening.
Alonzo, you got something to add on to that?
Yes, simply that in the courts who, you know, take one through the process of confinement, don't have no moral codes. They just use the legal standards that they set forth to imprison. And as it is, imprisonment now is like at the level of preventative detention. You know that you really don't even have to commit no crime. I got to go back to our good brother Malcolm, where he said that the whole of America is a prison to every black man, woman, and child in this country. So it's said today that the schools have became pipelines as a prison. So our babies is geared towards prison, and they don't have to be allegedly duly convicted. All they have to do is be accused or either slated to go to detention or either be brought to the attention of the police force that's in the school, not to mention the stop and frisk that is going to be more prevalent today than ever before. But these are tools that have been, you know, put in place long ago with the vagrancy laws, the lottery laws, after, you know, the Emancipation Proclamation we was all put in the street. And, yo, them black people, as they call us, the N-word, gonna be on them streets. They ain't got no keys. They ain't got no place to go. But we do have a jail cell for them to be on the, what's that, the work gang, the chain gang. Well, it's just a modernized situation where it became a little more sophisticated. And the sister mentioned Rescue 4, you know, where they're talking about the concentration camps that's already built, not to mention, and I hate to go there because people think of all that conspiracy theories, but damn, they got places where they got thousands of coffins lined up for people, and this is not the funeral industry, but they got thousands of coffins lined up for to put people in when the time comes. So all these things,
thank
is in
you.
A, you know, and they never sleep on the fact that it's a sleeping giant that is subject to retribute all of the wrong that was done to them, us, as a people. So they be guarded with these views, and they study it 5, 10, 15, 20 years, and we don't study nothing as a collective force to recognize that, you know, we got to save the babies, and the only way we could do that is to have our mess together, our thing together, come together,
yep,
and prepare for what is almost inedible.
Definitely. Before I go to Jen, I want to say one thing, because a lot of people think that Rex 84 is just a myth. Never forget, and they taught me this in their American history class when I was in the 11th or 12th grade, that when they locked up all the Japanese Americans during World War II because they was at war with Japan. So, and they, like, maybe 5 to 10 years ago, they gave each Japanese American who they locked up in those concentration camps $20,000+ each. So don't think that, you know, Rex 84 is some myth or it's some conspiracy theory jargon. I'm telling you what already has happened in this country. Now, with that being said, Jennifer, do you want to add on to the that question before we move on?
No, I think what Halabi and Mama Condi said is true, and it resonates a whole lot with me. I just gained a lot from listening to both of them share, and I know that you want to move forward with Ram, so I'll let you go ahead and do that, and maybe I could comment later before we end.
Definitely. With that being said, anybody got a question? Any audience members out there have any questions? Press 1 and I will see you. I'm going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to get into the interview with the illustrious Halabi. Peace to my people out there listening. I'd like to say once again, thank you for sharing time with us at No Shackle Radio. At this time, we're going to get into our interview portion with the illustrious Halabi. Halabi, I want you to tell us a little bit about yourself before I go into these questions.
Okay, well, I was described as a longtime member of the Promising Nation of Gods and Earth. And that essentially means that I acknowledged it myself since 1960, taught by a lot of father civilization. That's how, you know, I was taught. And taught this knowledge in Manhattan, which we call Mecca, as well as the Bronx, and many other places around the state and in other states as well. At one time, I had suffered as a political prisoner in New York State for almost 27 years, and it was the will and the power and force of the people that helped me break those chains, come back to free society, if you will. And since that time, I've been very productive, adding a contribution to the people by teaching, and more specifically, computer science and computer literacy at a law school in Mecca, and the whole senior exploration center in Chelsea. And it's been quite rewarding. And I continue to do what I do, teach. I'm a teacher by profession, and I love it, although I'm semi-retired, as I say, and know the struggle continues. So I'm involved with a lot of things that, you know, is particular to people, all human beings on the planet Earth, but more specifically to the original people who suffered the most in this hell called North America.
Okay, let me ask you this question right here. you said you did time. How much time did you do, and what was the circumstances behind you doing that amount of time?
Well, I did 27 years consecutively, and the major maximum security prisons in New York State. And the circumstances surrounding that I actually came to the aid of a youth, 13 years young, that was accosted by an adult, 39 years old. And I came to his aid, and he was accosted, you know, with a gun. I mean, an adult had a gun on a youth, and I did what I could to get him out of harm's way, out of danger. And the gun was turned on me, and as a result, the youth knew me and my brothers, and it alerted my brothers to the fact that now a guy got a gun on me. And I had my back turned to him, and one thing led to another. And subsequently, somebody was assaulted after firing six shots in the street indiscriminately, and I guess a murder occurred. And I say yes, because he really charged me with assault, and then later indicted me for murder with really no evidence. Witness that said that whatever it was alleged didn't occur. Are we still on?
Yes.
We still on, go
on. Oh, okay. Well, to cut it short because of brevity, I was convicted despite the fact that seven eyewitnesses to the crime that occurred said that I wasn't the perpetrator, but one came and said different. And he had ulterior motive, and it seemed as though it was a rigged deal that everybody that was involved with the trial was all white males that was involved with the district attorney. The judge was a former district attorney. It turned out later that my 18B lawyers was district attorney, former district attorney, and it later it was revealed by Lotta's father that he was threatened by Burton Roberts, who was the so-called super district attorney at that time, that said if he brought his teachings to the Bronx, where I was responsible and he sent to the Bronx to teach, that he would have his black ass put in jail. And this later came out in the copyright book by Barry Conter, who was the urban director of then Mayor Lindsay's administration. So it was a known fact that Burton Roberts was going to persecute anybody teaching Allah's teachings in the Bronx, and I was, if you will, the most responsible person up there in the Bronx, as I was sent from Harlem to the Bronx to be responsible for the young brothers and sisters up there that was coming to teach the Fibersons. And it all came around a time where the COINTELPRO program of J. Edgar Hoover was in full effect, although that, you know, the highlights and the more popular instance was their program against Dr. Martin Luther King, their program against Malcolm X, their program against Elijah Muhammad and Smokey Carmichael, the national black leaders of that time in the late 60s, early 70s. They really emphasized the fact of the young recruits that was coming under these national leaders' leadership. And Allah, the father as well, was one of the targets of Diego Hoover's COINTELPRO with 88 declassified pages later coming out of him being under surveillance. And a program ran against him and the Five Percenters, which I was a member of the Five Percenters. So their program was to neutralize, as they said, in word, anyone that had the potential to be a black messiah with the power to galvanize a national force, revolutionary force in America that they was aiming to neutralize. But their point five was really to concentrate on the youth, young recruits, of which I was one. And they, too, had a COINTELPRO against me, of which that quiet as it kept, and it's not quiet because they would never release my file, saying that it's still active. Can you imagine? After damn near 45 years, it's still an active program going on, and they continue to aim to protect those that's giving them the confidential information that they continue to receive. So aside from the politics, they continue to work to stop any progressive movements of black or Indian people in North America. It's just, you know, the fact that the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, the United States Constitution, was never to outlaw involuntary servitude or slavery in America. It was just changed for the corporate purpose to stop, if you will, the Civil War, so that they can get back to the general business of making money off of slave labor. But they just did it a different way. And imprisonment of blacks was that corporate way in which they did it. Now they just couldn't snatch us off of our lands and bring us here and imprison us by the borders that we didn't have the boats to get back. You know, take us through the courts and make them work for...
Let me ask you this.
Sorry, Wendy.
Did you... was you incarcerated during the time of the Attica riots?
Well, that's very interesting because I told you about the politics that, no, I wasn't. But on September 13th, I was involved with the only riot that took place in the streets. When the news hit the streets that our brothers had got killed in Attica prison, I was in the Bronx. And we got that news about 7:30 that evening. We all gathered on Tremont Avenue and Southern Boulevard. And it's only the only report of a riot that occurred in the streets on September 13th. And it was started by a sister named Lou Asia, who actually admonished us about not making the connection and realizing that we could have been up there with some of our brothers that was up there named Bishmi. Jasmi Allah was in the riot, and Dahu Allah and them, and that we could have been there just like them. And we stand out here, ain't doing nothing. And she actually picked up a garbage can and threw it through a plate glass window. And as we said, the S was on. And we ride from Southern Boulevard and Tremont Avenue to Western Avenue and Tremont Avenue. Up and down that car. That was a truck there. Okay, and 3 days later, on the September 16th, it was obviously that they was looking for the so-called leader of that ride, and I got arrested 3 days later with this case that resulted in 27 years.
So let me ask you this, right, before I get back into that situation, I want to know, I read somewhere that in the 70s that 5% used to go to the U.N. and sit in on the U.N., like, what was that about? Do you have any history on that?
Yeah, the father was invited to send representatives to the UN in 67 as a non-organizational governmental entity, I believe it was. And he selected a guard named Hashim from Medina, Brooklyn, to go to the UN as our UN representative. And that was about the first time, I think it was around in July of 1967. But I don't know for what reason, the papers wasn't filed for, I believe, a non-organizational entity or government where we continued to go as representatives. And the reason for that, I guess, it was that we was a sovereign, and we recognized ourselves as a sovereign, and the government recognized us as a sovereign, right? That we wasn't up under no charter of the United States government. And we had, a seat in the UN, although it was a non-voting seat, but they had the provisions for non-organization government of some of that nature. I mean, it was a while ago, and it wasn't followed up. But I remember when that had occurred, specifically, and I represented
okay,
it was from Medina.
So let me ask you this: when you went into prison in the '70s, right? Like, what was the condition of the prison environment when you went into prison?
Well, the conditions were deplorable, horrible. It was solid. I had a garage. Remember, I got arrested 3 days after the Attica ride. So everything, in a sense, was locked down. You know, the correction officers were very, very, very fearful that they'd not seen a state prison taken over. Prior to this, the city jails were being taken over at different instances with rides in the city jails. So it was straight up uprising and a constant rebellion, and we had a lot of knowledge and information. I'm talking about, we had Malcolm on the scene previous to him being assassinated. We had Dr. Martin Luther King on the scene previous to him being assassinated. We had a lot of fathers on the scene previous to him being assassinated. So we got all these teachings from all these brothers. Then we had a great slew of other brothers that was out there teaching. Dr. Kenneth Carr, Dr. Ben, yourself, Doc and Ben, Dr. What's my man's name? Clark. Damn, I can't think of Dr. Clark's first name. Oh, my goodness. He wrote The Black Man of the Now. Not Dr. Ben, but I'm sorry, my brother. Damn. And this is
John Henry Clark.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much, my sister. John Henry Clark. He was one of my teachers at the Harlem Teens for Self-Help in 1965. Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much. John Henry Clark. And that was a great brother.
That's my father.
That's your father?
Yep.
Wow. That was one of my teachers, boy, and I love him. Wow. And the last time I seen him, he came up to Shawanga Prison in 1989. He was blind at the time.
He was blind by then.
Yeah, he was blind. I told him I was one of his students, and he just laughed and asked me when and where. Wow. Yeah, but we had those great teachers, and we went to prison with all that great information. And we wasn't accepting the oppression, although we was really oppressed and repressed in the prison houses. We was fighting, and a change started coming by virtue of the demands of the Attica brothers. And one of the biggest changes was that they demanded an ombudsman committee, which later became two committees, the Legislative Committee and the Grievance Committee. And that gave us a voice in prison politics, if you will, where before, prisoners didn't have no voice. We were making 2.5 cents in the day, 2.5 cents in the afternoon. That was 5 cents a day. And making them license plates, and at that time, I think license plates cost $14 a watt. So, you know, it was really getting paid. Making clothes, it was really getting paid. We was only getting 5 cents a day. But things had changed to the extent that now we got a voice. They expanded the privileges and snacks, writing letters, school. They started college programs and opened up law libraries with Xerox machines and things of that nature, which we recognize as really a great pacification program, because nobody was really let go from prison in the time. It was essentially the same confined and oppressive incarceration that we had suffered before the Attica ride, during and after the Attica ride as well. But it changed.
So let me ask
voice. Yes.
So let me ask you this, because you was actually locked up in three different decades, the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, correct?
Yes.
Yes or no? Okay.
Yes.
Now, how did you see the prison movement or the prison consciousness politically change from the 70s to the 90s till you was released, I think around 97 or 98?
Well, that's a hell of a, you know, question, and I'm glad you asked it, because I think around 82, well, in the 70s, we were still struggling. You know, it was still a movement. You know, you still had the Black Panthers, the Muslims, Black Muslims, the Five Percenters, the Young Lords, and groups like that that was highly political and unifying, and we wasn't fighting each other. We was fighting the system. You know, our first grievance committee consisted of cross representation of the population of Black, Hispanic, and a white. So everybody was represented and we was unified. Then when the 80s came, it seemed as though all of the tricklings of the pacification program seemed to have an effect, because they came with the trailer visits or the visitation program, and guys seemed like they jumped over backwards for the visitation program, which really was a great revolutionary thing that we fought for, to be reunited with our families. Although we didn't get out of prison, which was our desire, we still fought for opportunity to have conjugal visits with visitation on the ground. And that was a great thing. But the program and the isolation and interviews that they had with different people, it gave them the force or the leverage to take the weaker ones and turn them into informers or either individuals that wasn't getting down with the struggle that we had undertaken in the late 60s and the 70s. So the struggle, although it continued, it seemed like it began to get watered down. Because they catered to some of the stronger brothers to give them the trailer visits first, and some of the stronger brothers proved to be some of the weaker visits when they thought about, you know, they having opportunities in the trailer visit to get sex and things of that nature with a woman and forget the revolution, forget the struggle, and things of that nature. So it significantly, because people became more isolated and had private, personal interviews and was doing things behind closed doors or informing, and you would never know who really was the informer, you know, and things became like, damn, you had to watch your back. It wasn't no more unity, a great amount of distrust. And then following that, with the creation of the distrust, in the later 80s, the gangs started becoming more proliferated, in that the Bloods started rising. I believe they came from California or what, and the Crips started rising, and next thing you know, they fighting each other, and we didn't have that unity no more, where those that came out of the 70s had that unity, and the early 80s had that unity, and now, I guess following the crack epidemic as well, it kind of changed in the late 80s, where brothers and was fighting amongst each other for whatever reason. You know, they just total distrust, false alliances with gang activity and things of that nature, to the extent that it became so crazy and proliferated that the correction officers start forming gangs and setting other gangs against each other, and at the same time started supplying other gangs, the gangs that they were affiliated with, you know, weapons, high-grade weapons, switchblade knives and bigger knives and access to pipes and things of that nature. And they say, you know, they was orchestrating the way that somebody would get seriously hurt, if not killed. And unity seemed, just before I was leaving, didn't exist, not to mention that in the 80s, they closed all of the mental institutions and send a great amount of those people that was mentally challenged, you know, that either went crazy in jail, to the prisons, and started a serious psychotropic program where Thorazine was king, and it was a lot of brothers, that became dependent upon Thorazine, Prolixin, and things of that nature. And that was really very liquid handcuffs where you would see a whole block of individuals that was dependent upon those chemicals. In fact, the last institution that I left from was Sullivan. And Sullivan was an institution, a mass institution, but it had a mix of your more so-called incorrigible, high-profile, end-of-the-line prisoner, along with your most drug-dependent, psychologically challenged prisoner. And they had a whole block, D block, that was exclusively for them brothers that was on Thorazine. And I taught in the D block unit these brothers that was on the drugs. And they could remember, in my estimate, as I was instructing them in the class for that day, but they would come back the next day, and it seemed like they didn't remember nothing that I had told them the day before. You know, and yeah,
let me
that,
interject real quick. So you saying that as from the '70s to the '90s, as time progressed, their tactics to break the movement became either more sophisticated or they started using low sophistication techniques, but still they was working.
Well, I like the way you put it, because in the beginning, they, you know, used sophisticated tactics. That right after Attica, they had to appease us because the public eye was on the prisoners in New York State, if not across the country. So they became giving up more education, more doctors came in, nurses, more teachers, and things of that nature. They became a little more humane, because they opened it up and let more people from the general society come in besides correction officers, or hacks, as we call them then, right? And then in the 80s, it kind of shifts with the closing of the mental institutions, the people that was coming to jail messing with crack, the influx of the new gangs that was coming to New York in the mid-80s, and as well as the gangster rap. And then they got like more, we don't give a damn because we got these captive fools and they following our instructions. And now they straight up became like, we can get real reckless and lead them into the destruction of their goddamn self. And that's how it seemed in the end. You know, that they had a whole block of people that was on straight up drugs that they was giving them, you know, not to mention in the general population, the guys that was getting drugs from wherever they was getting it, you know, from the police or their visitors or whatever the case may be, and they've been and fighting for that. You know, they had control with the drugs and the violence that came from it. So it wasn't no more a real struggle. The Grievance Committee became a shambles. Odor still was functioning. The Liaison Committee became a shambles. Odor was functioning. And the only real thing that was taking place in terms of, and we don't talk about rehabilitation, but self-improvement, was the education program. The people that came to teach, they really was teachers. And the nurses that came in prisons, they was generally about helping heal or healing others. But the administration, they had a definite plan to keep everybody divided and fighting amongst themselves, or either on drugs or isolated in themselves.
That's crazy. I want to pause for a minute to ask my co-host, do any of y'all have any questions y'all would like to ask the Law D?
Yes, this is Mama Condi. I want to thank you, Brother Law, first of all, for being willing to come and present here in our forum. I thank you very much for that. My next question is, now that we've been crumped and we're no longer between a killery and a crump,
uh-huh,
how do you think that will affect, how do you think that will affect what we're trying to do in terms of rights for prisoners and the abolishment of the 13th Amendment. How do you think that this new Crump will respond?
Well, I would like to think that, like, California is a very progressive state, but it seems like Colorado, you know, is coming forth and leading the state with the legalization of marijuana, and he is at present the first one to even put a referendum on the books about abolishing the 13th Amendment. I would like to, you know, be optimistic to think that we got some foresight to correct some of these wrongs that's taking place. I mean, the driving force is what is really important, that if we push and we push right for making the change that, you know, need to be made, then, you know, things could be changed. We could actually make a significant change. And it's a big thing to go at the very foundation of the laws that was written by the so-called founding fathers establishing the government. But a lot of people don't realize that the government, as they said, was for the people, other people, by the people, really wasn't other people, for the people, nor by the people. It was for the corporate entity, the land owners, the planters, as they call them. Then they put the Constitution together, and they totally compromised us, that we was not considered no more than three-fifths of a man, and that was just as so-called property of the planter, the landowner. So to turn all of that around, we'd have to make everybody aware of the foundation of thing was predicated upon, I say, straight up bullshit, and make them aware that you're living a lie, and if you continue to buy the lie and accept, you know, what we just experienced in the Trump coming to forehead as now the president-elect and got the people very, very fearful. And the people really shouldn't be fearful. I mean, he ain't going to be no different than any other president. And we went through war, slavery, Jim Crow, and now mass incarceration. And the brother mentioned how they deterred, interned the Japanese and didn't even mess with the Germans, who was Caucasian, incidentally, and put them on, you know, in concentration camps. So we experienced all that. We know all those things, and we just got to be unfearful and fight for the right, you know, to be free. Not the civil right, not the so-called legal rights or the privileges that's allegedly afforded, but the human rights that's ineligible, and stand our ground. But we definitely got to educate a very ignorant population, you know, and our people is ignorant so much to the extent that they do most of the things that is detrimental to themselves as opposed to doing things that's beneficial to themselves. And it's a sorry state, but it's not a hopeless state, although it seems hopeless, and it could become a point of desperation because of that hopelessness, because, damn, it's no longer the cloak or the cover of them not being racist. They done showed their bigotry, and now the leader is not only a billionaire of the so-called free world, but he's a bigot, racist billionaire, and the president of the so-called most powerful country in the world. And that's enough to be fearful of, but fear would only paralyze you. You know, that's something that we got to strategize and fight the good fight as our ancestors have to bring us this far, you know, and never give up.
Let me definitely, that was a good piece right there. Jennifer, do you got anything? Because we time is always is of the essence. Do you got anything to add on, Jennifer, or are you good?
Yeah, I just want to ask, you talked a lot about some things that I am interested in terms of the mental health treatment inside of the prison and things of that nature, and I just wanted to ask you, what do you think, how do you think things are going to turn out as far as the type of services that are offered inside the prison going forward? Because right now there's a lot of issues with the health care and also mental health care and other types of rehabilitative services. And I find that it's difficult for a lot of different reasons to try to provide any type of rehabilitative services inside of the prison because the atmosphere does not support it. Also, at the same time, a lot of the practices that are being used are Western practices that were created by white men, you know, for lack of a better explanation. So one of the things that I'm interested in is improving the type of services that are offered on some level and moving away from Western culture and moving towards things that are more beneficial for the people that are affected by the prison system. So I just wanted to know what your thoughts were on that, considering that we have this new administration coming. Do you see any positive changes coming within the prison, or do you think things are going to get worse?
Well, I see things will get worse for the simple reason that they're not going to embrace the administrations of, you know, prisons is not going to embrace anything of any holistic remedies or medicines, right? And they're going to go like the way of big business, they being a business, are the major pharmaceuticals. And the pharmaceuticals push the drugs that they definitely instruct their doctors to promote. You know, not only the psychotropic drugs that they got, the prolixin, the thorazine, the lithium, and all of them drugs is a part of the system today in every state, you know, and I've seen it, and it's horrible. And it just does great damage to the body as well, to those brothers, you know, they brain cells, they bone structure and everything of that nature. And they haven't addressed it and don't intend to address it. Like, Umia is going through a big issue with Hep C, I believe. And I know his personal doctor.
Yeah, that's correct.
It's a good brother. And, you know, he's going through it. And they actually denied him through the courts of his proper treatment. And they Yes, ma'am. And they know the proper treatment. And they denied him through the courts. I mean, he went through the courts for remedy that they know that, you know, this is what he's supposed to get, and this is how it's supposed to be given, but we can't enforce the law where you can get it. You just got to wait. And such is the case, and this is a national case, a well-known case. So if they, you know, do it to one who is well-known, and you know it for reasons they're doing it, they don't care about the other ones. Yeah. And the business is not going to be to help no prisoners get good help. And, again, our steps got to be, in my estimate, to do what we got to do that we can bring help to these brothers. Like my good brother, Dr. Harris, he's not only helping Mamiya, but he's doing things in New York that is going right to the people, and he's a people doctor. Now, we get more doctors like that, maybe we could, you know, make those inroads like he's doing, and go in and help them brothers to some extent, you know, find the ways and the procedures to become more people's doctors, either the people's doctors, serving the people's, not only in the street, but in prison as well. But
definitely.
From their corporate business, they're not giving up.
Let me interject a bit, because time is always of the essence. And like, I want to add on a little bit, but first and foremost, man, I want to thank you, Alar B, for, you know, taking the time out your schedule to come on the radio show, No Shackle Radio, and things of that nature. But At this time, that's a few announcements I want to make. One announcement I want to make and updates I want to make is that, you know, we have an initiative. We're trying to sell X amount of T-shirts, sweatshirts, hoodies, and things like that because, like I said, this is a people power movement. If you go to my page, Malar Divine, you'll see me one day I had on one of the hoodies, which is a nice hoodie, and it was nice and warm as well, that, you know, we're trying to raise funds as well because, you know, anytime you're trying to do things independently from a grassroots perspective, especially dealing with something like what we're dealing with, prison rights, prison advocacy, trying to abolish the 13th Amendment, nobody, no corporate sponsors want to give us any money. Why? Because our success means their downfall. So in the coming next couple of days, go to our Facebook page, which is called The Millions for Prisoners, the Millions for Prisoners March on Washington. That's our Facebook page. Go to that, and you'll see, you know, different postings about, you know, the T-shirts, where you can get your T-shirts from, where you can get the sweatshirts from. If you drink coffee like me, where you can get the mugs from and tote bags and different things like that, as well as for supporters out there. You know, if you want to support the Millions for Human Rights, the Millions for Human Rights Prisoners March, you can go to our webpage, which is iamweubuntu.com, and you can go to what is called our team. When you look at our team, you will see the list of people that's the local organization reps. If you don't see a local organization rep that you can contact, then you can send an email to iamweubuntu.com, Millions for Prisoners Human Rights, or you can just click on the link there. And if you're a part of any organization and you want to show solidarity with the Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March, we also got a page for you as well. All this is at iamweubuntu. Just go to .com, excuse me. And if you go there, you will see what we got. As well as, we're still, like I said, we're a grassroots movement. We're learning just like you're learning. We're doing just like you're doing. There's no big I's or little U's. We all one. We all the ants. And we're still looking for people with grant writing skills, event planning skills, and media skills. You know, if you want to add on, let us know. Visit our page. Visit I Am We Ubuntu. And if you know any congressmen and lawmakers that's friendly to abolishing the 13th Amendment or friendly to prison human rights thing, let us know as well. Because like I said, man, you know, we know as much as you know. And all of us pulling our brain power together, we can know a lot more. You know, we depend on the people for this march. And we need your support. Just like when you see us post things in the group, the Millions of Prisoners Human Rights March on D.C., you know, share that on your page. Because the more people that know what's going on, it's the better that we can be. Because August 19, 2017 is right around the corner. We're just weeks away from January, really. So we need everybody to get down with us. We need everybody to pull together. You know, I am because we are. Always remember that. Because we all one. We all one, no matter what. You know, we want to defeat these people in Washington that's going to try to push divisiveness. We got to all show up August 19th. But we need to organize right now. We need everybody to get on board with us and organize. Join local organization committees, and if there is not one, start one. You know, we got to get off the sideline, and we got to get into the game. And that's just the fact of the matter. So before I close out, I want to give each one of my co-hosts and as well as my guests last words. I'm going to start with Mama Condi.
If there is a caller, I I'd like to relinquish my time to a caller that didn't have an opportunity to get in.
There's no callers in the queue right now.
All right. Then I would like to thank everyone for listening. Thank you very much, Brother Allah. This elder is grateful and appreciates you. Thank you very much for being here.
You're welcome, my sister. Thank you for having the phone.
Jen?
I just want to say thank you to Alaudi for sharing his knowledge and wisdom this evening. I learned a great deal from listening to you talk about your experiences and the different changes that was witnessed in the system. And I also appreciate your insight about what may happen for us in the future.
Yes, thank you as well, sis. And appreciate you being
here. Leave us with some parting words.
Well, I'd like to thank y'all for the effort that you're making to abolish the 13th Amendment. I wrote a piece in 91 that I won a second place award called Teaching by Statute, and it was centered around the 13th Amendment. So this has been dear to my heart because ever since I read that, you know, slavery and involuntary servitude couldn't be had unless one being duly convicted, I knew that that was a trick, and everybody went for it, and we got to do something about this trick. So it's good to see that y'all is coming together and alerting the people of this mass trick of, you know, changing the laws from a corporate perspective nonetheless. And it's always been about dollars, economics, you know, and we could change things if we could change the foundation of the lies that have been laid so many years ago. And the 13th Amendment was a big lie with the Emancipation Proclamation, 13th Amendment, you know, so we got to get that right. Lincoln ain't free no slaves, you know, so I go there if I could impart anything, that would be, you're on the right track, and I thank y'all for being on the right track.
Definitely, we thank you for sharing your experiences. We thank you sharing for your knowledge with us, and definitely everybody that's out there listening, we need your support. The Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March that's going to take place August 19, 2017. My name is Malar Devon Malar. I'm the Prisoners Champion. You got the People's Champion. I'm the Prisoners Champion. And I'd like to say thank y'all for listening. Definitely.
All right, sir.
Understand our prison system.
Prisoners under the 13th Amendment essentially work as
in a form of neo-slavery.
End mass incarceration.
Millions for Prisoners Human Rights.
March on Washington, August 2017.
No Shackles Radio.